It was wet. When I stepped out, it was slippery and it was wet. What I saw, I had never seen in my life before. Like,
you're listening to Shaukat Shafi, a resident photojournalist, talk about what he saw at a Rohingya refugee camp in Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh.
Suddenly, it started raining. It started raining, and that made it very worse. There was a truck at the center, and there were more than 1,000 people around the truck. Women, men, children of every age. And almost most of them, 99% of them, were without any shoes, like they were barefoot. People were like, they were fighting with the mud and they were fighting with the people, like they were, they wanted to get some food. Everyone needs everything. They need food, they need water, they need clothes, they need everything. There is no one in them who has like something, at least something. No, they need everything. Everyone in them needs everything.
I'm Jasmine Bayoumi. Today, we want to talk about the utter mind-bender that's the job of covering the world's fastest-growing refugee crisis. The Rohingya escaping unprecedented brutality in their homeland, Myanmar, and fleeing to Bangladesh. We sent two people to Bangladesh, photojournalist Shaukat Shafi, whom you've just heard, and editor Saif Khalid.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Can you tell me why are all these people coming from Myanmar in the first place?
So these Rohingya ethnic groups, they have been living there for generations. But the Myanmar authorities, or you can say the military primarily, they have never accepted them. They call them as Bengalis who have come from the neighboring Bangladesh. After I went there, I interviewed hundreds of them. None of them spoke Bengali. So we had to take a translator. So this thing that, you know, they're Bengalis and they have moved to Myanmar recently is a lie. Rohingyas are not allowed to even move from one village to another village. They have to take permission to marry. So it's like a huge state repression under which they have been living there for generations. They're not even second-class citizens. They're not even given, you know, citizenship. So they have nothing.
So why the sudden exodus?
They have been being pushed out for the last decade, I would say. It started in late 70s. It seems like ethnic cleansing, which the UN has admitted. So over the period of time, they have been completely pushed to the wall. And then an armed group actually cropped up. Last October, when the Rohingya group, which is called as ARSA, it's like abbreviation, it's called ARSA. They attacked last October. Then the army started acting against the Rohingyas. So when army goes after the Rohingyas, it doesn't differentiate between the armed groups or the civilians. It went after all of the entire group. And that movement continued until as late as February and March of this year. And then this attack happened in August. And since August 25, we have seen more than 5 million. So basically, the Myanmar military was waiting for an opportunity to go after them.
To go after them. By now, many of you are familiar with the stories of hundreds of thousands of Rohingya who fled to Bangladesh as a direct result of what Saif is talking about. To be a little bit more accurate, the UNHCR puts the refugees number at more than 500,000. You're also probably familiar by now that in most such stories, the bulk of those who flee are also the weakest and most vulnerable. That's women and children. And of course, Myanmar's army chief has surprised nobody by accusing the media of exaggerating the numbers of those who are fleeing. But numbers don't matter anymore. 200,000 people fleeing massacres isn't somehow better than 500,000 people fleeing massacres. What's important are each of those 200,000 or 500,000 stories. like this one.
My baby was in my lap when the soldiers hit me and he fell out of my arms. Then they pulled me closer to the wall and I could hear that he was crying. Then after a few minutes, I could hear that they were hitting him too. My baby was thrown into the fire and then they raped me.
So imagine, what used to be empty land just a few months ago in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, just across the Naf River from Myanmar, is now teeming with broken people, living in tents made out of reed and tarp, happy to be alive, but desperate for food, medical care, and basic sanitation.
One thing I want to say here, it is not normal refugee crisis, what we have seen in the world. It is beyond, it's a different refugee crisis. I know every pain is like, for every person, his pain is very painful, you know, like, but this is something different. It is not a normal refugee crisis. It is not, it's like a sea of people. They have come from, they escaped saving their lives. They have seen atrocities all over their life. All over their life, they have seen atrocities. They have never seen any happiness in their life. Now they came to another country, which is also poor, and they saved their life, but maybe they will die of hunger now.
I think many people underestimate what it takes to come to Bangladesh. What's the journey that they have to take?
The situation is really very tense over there. The people, they are coming by boats, and when they reach near the border of Bangladesh, they don't wait for the boat to reach to exact border. They jump from the boat and they swim and they reach to the border. The people who are coming from there, they have nothing with them. Most of them, when they reach to the shores of the Bangladesh, they faint there because they have been walking for many days. You can see by their physical appearance, like, they are not eating well in their own country. But the problem is, they are coming to Bangladesh, and Bangladesh is one of the poorest countries of the world. And there, they are living in a small space. More than 500,000 people are living in such a small space. Like, there are people everywhere. You can see, like, if you see towards right or left, there are people everywhere.
Wow, that sounds like it's really, really chaotic.
It is very chaotic over there. Like, there are people everywhere. Wherever you see, there are people. There are people, and they are like running for food, and they are looking for food. They are looking for shelter.
So that chaos, like, what other symptoms does it show? Like, what scenes have you guys witnessed that are just so symbolic of the chaos that's
like,
going on?
There are many aid agencies helping them, international aid agencies, local people, local charities. And when a truck with the aid comes, the people jump over the truck. The healthy people, the men who can run, they jump over the truck and they take the food from that. The women, the old and the children, they are left behind. It's like the survival of the fittest over there. That is the problem. And international aid agencies and the local charities, they are really struggling to reach out to all the people.
I interviewed this woman, actually. I wrote a story on her. We were near an aid truck. Hundreds, maybe more than 1,000 Rohingyas were actually just, they were trying to grab a packet of aid. That woman was, she couldn't go into that because, you know, she was holding her one-year-old child on her lap and she was crying. What brought my attention is not just her cry. It was raining and that kid was sleeping. A normal kid would never sleep while it's raining. Naturally, I was like really, it kind of really like broke my heart. And then I approached her and then I started talking to her. Then I put my umbrella over the kid so that, you know, that doesn't go out of my mind. So it's that kind of situation. It's that level of helplessness. She said that her husband was killed. So she is here on her own with two of her kids. One was 2-year-old, one is 1-year-old. old. So what do you do to that? It's not that, you know, people are not helping. People have been very generous. Bangladeshi people have been very generous, especially after their prime minister announced that, you know, they're ready to help them, though it's a poor country, but they have opened up their hearts and, you know, houses for them.
Was there a situation you just weren't mentally prepared for?
I had never been to that kind of situation. It was really heartbreaking situation. At times when I was interviewing that woman I described earlier, my translator started crying.
Shaukat, how about you?
I have been to Europe and covered the European refugee crisis. And that was really bad. In my head, it was like, I thought it will be same. But I have to say it was worse than that. It was really worse than that. And I had never seen such a terrible thing in my life. So I was not really prepared for this kind of a thing.
I think one of the most difficult story for me was the children's story, which I did. And it was very difficult to ask a 9-year-old and 10-year-old about the fact that his or her father or parents were killed, butchered by the Myanmar army. Children as young as 10 years old narrated that they saw when the attack happened, they ran and hid in the bushes. One of them, a 10-year-old Rashid, he's still not come out of his shock and, you know, trauma. And he has his 6-year-old sister to take care of. I spoke to the counselors there. They said that, you know, every often he comes to them and asks them that, you know, my dad and my parents were killed by the army. And other significant thing which I observed and which every Rohingya, including the children, pointed out, the army. There's a fear of the army among them. They don't talk about Suu Kyi or anybody else. They only talk about army, fear of the army.
With that chaos, and I'm picturing in my head just like thousands and thousands of tents on hills, what is the health situation like? Are people already working towards that?
To be precise, there is nothing about hygiene over there right now. They are just looking for food and looking for shelter. And there are no toilets. There is no clean water. There is nothing. Whatever they get, they eat it. At the distribution camps, people wait for 3 to 4 hours to receive a food packet, a single food packet. And most of the Rohingya refugees, they have just one meal a day. That is the situation over there. So the health conditions are like, they are, the problem is like, as most of the international aid agencies and the government is trying to reach the people, like they are worried about the epidemic. Maybe there will be, cholera or some other disease.
What type of diseases or illnesses or sickness have you guys seen over there?
So the people who were coming from the boats, they were having two problems. One, rashes on their body, and they were having fever. Most of them had fever. And diarrhea, there were some people with diarrhea. Most of the people who were fleeing from Myanmar, they were struggling with these three diseases. As I spoke to a doctor, these three diseases are very common in the people who are coming by boats.
Diarrhea in a place without toilets.
And there's a place, the area where the tents are, it's very smelly. It smells really very bad. It's not in a like position to live. Like a normal human being will not live over there. So I asked a Rohingya how he's living here. He said, I am safe here. That's why I'm here. So I don't care about the smell. But it is not a proper place to live.
As Shaukat rightly pointed out, it's not a place where a normal person would go and live. It's not a livable place. It's basically jungle. They have just come and they have cut the trees and put up their tents on the hillocks. So it's really bad situation as far as their immediate basic amenities are concerned. Like, you know, they do not have even basic water facility. We haven't seen any death due to diseases so far. So there are warnings that, you know, things might get worse. But so far, it's been under control. So that's a very significant point.
What's the biggest act of kindness that you saw there?
I saw this Bangladeshi man. He was wearing this traditional kameez shalwar, like the traditional dress, which mostly people wear in South Asia. And he was having a beard.
and he was having a skull cap, and his shoes were like he was wearing a torn shoes. Like I can see his thumb out of it, and he was giving away 500 taka notes, the local currency, to the people. And when I asked him for a photo, he didn't allow me to take a picture. He said, "No, I am here to help my brothers and sisters." I asked him, "Why is he helping?" He said, "Like it's my duty to help them." And he said, he feels he is a very fortunate man. He has enough money to help some people. You know, he was feeling like you could feel it. Like he said, "I am very fortunate," and that showed me like that is the lesson I'll take with me for life. Like, yeah, it really don't need money to be generous. It needs a human heart. And that guy is the best example of the human heart.
No doubt, sweet moments like this one happen over and over again during the most miserable times. Then, there are those other moments that are far from sweet. Ones where the pain and anguish of people is laid bare, and there's no turning away from it. For photojournalists like Shaukat, capturing those moments is hard.
There was this Hindu Rohingya girl. She was 16 years old. She was 6 months pregnant. Her husband was killed in Myanmar, and she had crossed over with her other relatives to Bangladesh. And she was describing her pain and her story to a journalist over there, and then suddenly she started crying. And there were some local men, they took out mobile phones from their pocket and they started recording it. Like, for them she was just an object, you know. And that time I stopped. Like, that it's still in my head. I have not got the answer of this question. Like, I thought, like, how, like, that was very disgusting for me. I felt very bad over there. But then I thought, like, I am also doing same. Like, they took picture of these, and I am also taking picture of other Rohingyas. They are also in the pain. So that made me think somehow, like, if I am in the right profession, like, if my pictures are really helping these people or not, you know. So it started haunting me for a few days. Like, I was very, like, very upset with my profession, with my life, what I am doing. I am taking pictures of the pain of the people. Like, it's my job. I get money out of it. I get salary out of it. And I was really feeling bad. I was really thinking if really my pictures are helping them or not. But then I started getting mails. I started getting messages from friends, from relatives, from other people, from some unknown people. They messaged me, "Hey, we saw your pictures. We really want to help them." And many of them, like, they offered help. Many of them, they asked me how they can help. And they say, "We never knew about this. This thing is happening. But because of your pictures, we came to know." But that thing made me somehow know, like, the journalism part is also important.
When we first started the debrief in September, we made you a promise. We said that while others tell you about where the rockets were fired from, we'd tell you about where they land. So, I'm going to leave you with this letter that a Rohingya refugee wrote and recorded for the world to hear. You probably can't get any closer to the ground zero of this story than this. Until next week, take care.
For all my life, all 24 years of it, I have been a prisoner in this open-air jail you know as Rakhine State. I was born in Myanmar, as were my parents, but my citizenship was snatched away before I was even conceived. My movement, education, access to healthcare and career have been heavily restricted because of my ethnicity. I am banned from working in the government, denied the right to pursue higher education, barred from visiting the capital Yangon, and even stopped from leaving Northern Rakhine State. I am subjected to to the worst form of discrimination, all because I am a Rohingya Muslim. For years, my people who have been denied their most basic rights are killed on a near daily basis. Shot that in plain sight, forcibly and systematically made homeless, our homes razed in front of our very eyes. We are the victims of a brutal state. For you to fully appreciate what our conditions are like, I'm going to use an analogy. Imagine a mouse stuck in a cage with a hungry cat. That's what it's like for the Rohingya. Our only method of survival is to run or hope someone helps us get out. For those of us that have remained, there's a systematic campaign to separate us from the wider Rakhine community. We are called Kala, that is, dirty, stingy people, by Buddhists to our faces. Whether you are a child or an old man, no one escapes the abuse. We face a discrimination at schools and at hospitals, and there's been a fresh campaign by Buddhists to avoid us at all cost via boycott. Only buy from the Buddhist. They say, if you give a penny to a Buddhist, they will help build a pagoda, that is temple. But if you give a penny to a Muslim, they will build a mosque. These kinds of comments, they have become the norm and helped fuel Buddhist extremists to attack us. When Aung San Suu Kyi, a Nobel Peace Prize winner, won parliamentary elections in 2015 and ended half a century of dominance by the military, we had high hopes change was coming. We were confident that this woman, hailed as a beacon of democracy, would end our abuse and oppression. Sadly, it soon became clear not only would she not be our voice, she would ignore our suffering. Her silence showed she was complicit to the violence, that she had zero morals. In the end, she failed us. Our last hope failed us. In 2012, a huge number of Rohingya were slaughtered in one of the worst bursts of communal violence. Around 140,000 people were internally displaced, an event that would repeat itself in 2016. Shot, slaughtered, and burnt alive in front of their families, the violence last October would give rise to the Arkan Rohingya Salvation Army, ASA, a small group of men who decided to defend themselves and fight back. Armed with just sticks and stones, they knew they couldn't fend off the well-equipped Myanmar army, but tried nonetheless. Still, now our sisters and mothers are forced to give birth in paddy fields as we run for our lives in this violence that you say is between two equal sides. It is not. Children are being shot as they flee and women's bodies floating in rivers. It's not an equal fight. We are facing extinction, and unless the international community stands with us, one of the most persecuted people in the world, we will face genocide, and you all will be a party to it. Thanks.